Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Rafa from Bristol, and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, if you opened a restaurant, what would it be called, and what would be the best seller? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello everybody, and welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked, and we're talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Rafa from Bristol's question, if you opened a restaurant, what would it be called, and what would be the best seller? Dane, I actually have the answer to this, pre-prepared from a long time ago. Because me and my wife want to open a restaurant one day that only serves the things that they bring round at weddings, you know, like appetizers. So you
just
pay like
canapés.
Yeah, so it's just the restaurant's called Canapés, and you just come in, you pay 25 quid, and we'll keep bringing these things round all night, and then we make our money on the booze. So
I like that.
I like that.
That's a really good idea. It's like a tapas train.
There you go. Yeah, lovely, lovely.
I get that. Yeah, I like that idea. I feel like I would do something similar. I would have I don't know how to call it though. I feel like I'm going to call it Bap Squires. I feel like that gives it it's like an upscale suffix, right? It's like down to earth, and the prefix suffix is upscale. And I think I like your idea as well of having almost like a canapé train. So I want to do something similar because I want people to enjoy lots of variety. But I also wanted it to be like a massive takeaway option. I want like if we ever lock down again, people could just get like orders of these different canapés and stuff as well. But that being said, the best seller I think would be the CBD sundae.
Yeah, you are very keen to mix CBD with food.
With frozen treats, yeah. I think mixing it with food, because think about it. If you take your kids for a CBD sundae, and you can also bring grandma or mima as well, her arthritis is taken care of by the CBD. The kids shut the fuck up. Or if they have epilepsy, they also feel relaxed as well. And everyone enjoys a delicious family treat and goes home ever more relaxed, knowing that any degenerative diseases have been mitigated somewhat by this ice cream sundae.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Well, there you go. So, suffice to say, on this show, we ask and answer all the questions like that one from Rafa, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. Any question people like. No question is too stupid, too intelligent, and too CBD-infused. So, if you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify, and you'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all of our questions and answers from all of our very special guests. With that being said, on today's show, our guest is a writer and comedian. He was raised as a Buddhist before living with Native Americans and finally settling down as a trainee rabbi. He's the writer and star of BBC Radio 4 sitcom Josh Howie's Losing It, nominated for a BBC Radio Award, and he's one of the stars of the sitcom Papillus, currently available on Channel 5's on-demand platform. And he is also the first comedian whose show I saw in its entirety at the Edinburgh Festival and was a massive influence. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Josh Howie.
Wow, thank you very much. And I remember seeing your set, and it must have been super early, downstairs at Top Secret when it was in the African Centre.
Oh yeah, I remember.
And wow. I mean, you must have been going, I don't know how long you'd be going, a couple of months maybe?
Yeah,
I think so. But you absolutely blew me away. I mean, I came up to you and I was like, this guy's going to be a massive star and I want to be friends with him now so that one day, many years from now, he will invite me onto his podcast, even though I have no profile compared to his other guests.
I disagree. I feel
you're bringing some of those Radio 4 listeners. You're bringing us...
Exactly.
You know,
and also, comedian as well. You know, someone who has already had an affinity with the Black British comedian community way before being woke was in vogue. So always been ahead of the curve, in my personal opinion. So I feel very privileged to have you on the podcast. How have you been, Mr. Josh Howie?
I'm all right, man. I've spent a year and a bit like homeschooling five kids. So when I say I'm all right, I mean I'm absolutely traumatized, and my children are traumatized as well. That is, I'm not very good with mental health issues. I have no empathy. So when I hear like people say mental health this and that, I'm just like, you losers with your mental health. What's your problem? Just buck up your ideas.
I was once like you.
Now I get it.
Have you Absolutely. Have you sold the book rights to the story of you looking after these children and homeschooling them for a year?
I am not that level of hustler.
Right, yeah. We should talk after the show because it's like, okay. You've seen Room, the producer. Right? You've seen Room. Yeah. You know, it's...
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's...
This is much worse.
Funnier. Potentially funnier as well, which is probably, you know...
I mean, less sexual abuse, but...
which is always good. Whatever people tell you.
I should have said no sexual abuse. I realise that now. I'm sorry. Let me reset. No sexual abuse.
And it's also when we put it out, I forgot what that film was about. I thought it was just a person trapped in it. I forgot about the bad stuff outside, you know, that goes on in sorry.
Yeah, you were just thinking all the good, the happy stuff. The kid gets a haircut. Yeah.
Well, just being trapped in a room. We've all had that for
it's
a year.
It's really so, yeah. Like a remake of Little Miss Sunshine when you think about it.
Oh dear. Well, it's got in an interesting direction, isn't it, Dane? It's probably time for a question, as the format of this show dictates.
Absolutely. As our very esteemed guest, Mr. Josh Howie, we invite you to ask our first question, any question you would like, which we'd like to discuss for 15 minutes and some change. And then my co-host, Howard, will ask a question and we will do the same. And then lather, rinse, repeat. I will ask you a question which we'd like to discuss. And then when we are all done exchanging these streams of consciousness, we'd like our listeners to find out where they can find out about your best work and some of your previous work and work in the future too. How does this sound?
Sounds great.
Lovely. Well, then the floor is yours, sir, to ask the first question, please.
Okay. This is a question of both of you. It's called Dane's Ask Question. Yeah, but I guess what I want to ask is, what do you think the definition of Zionism is?
wicked. Yeah.
Just coming in, you know.
Nothing to
keeping
that.
It light.
Nothing to see Always. Here. Just God, it's a great question because you know I've known Josh for a while. Dane, not as long as Dane, but I've known Josh for a while. We conversed about kind of some things in the past. It's a fucking crazy time for these kind of conversations that we're having, right? Like I know we're about to have it, but like just to preface the fact that the way that word is bandied around at the moment is pretty frightening.
It is frightening because I'm just gonna say I'm a Zionist, so and so are 90%+ of Jewish people. It's just like I listened to your podcast with Ash sure. from a few weeks ago, which is great. And I thought she made lots of very valid and insightful comments. But there are a few things, if I'm honest, that Dane said that kind of shocked me a little bit, concerned me, if I'm honest as well. And I just wanted to talk, because I think a lot of those misconceptions sort of seem to come maybe from around what that word means. And when I say... I'm talking about like, you know, its actual definition as opposed to what various people think it to mean.
Mm. And I think that, I mean, Dane, I don't know what you think, but I think that phrase, that word has been what it would have meant when we were kids. It doesn't mean that, or it doesn't seem to mean the same anymore.
If we give a definition, as I understand, of Zionism, and then if it is erroneous, then Josh can correct me, which I think is the best way forward. So as far as I understand Zionism, or the contemporary definition of Zionism, would reference to, I guess, the political movement to have a Jewish state for the, protection and for the allowance of the thriving of the global Jewish community being located in Israel. And
roughly,
that's pretty much
roughly,
as far as I
roughly
understand
Israel.
I think you've nailed it. It's an emancipation movement to set up a state to allow the Jewish people to have self-determination within our ancestral homeland. So absolutely.
Well, and by Jewish as well, I should add, that's referring to the the ethno-social group as opposed to the faith itself,
well,
right?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, Judaism in itself is obviously a very defining it, it's actually, the technical definition is an ethno-religious state. Mm-hmm.
Ethno-religious.
Ethno-religious people. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, Howard's surname is Cohen. Mm-hmm. There is actually like a Cohen gene that, that goes at like an identifying code. You know, there are mm-hmm. diseases and medical conditions that only affect Jewish people. Mm-hmm. And
I thought you were about to say Cohen's then for a second, which I was going to start to fucking Google that.
You should probably check how to be
honest. You should check out. Find that Cohen gene.
Yeah.
And there is a common ancestry of when you look at Jewish DNA. That is what I understand it to be as well. And like I said, 90 to 96% of Jews around the world and 100% of Jews in Israel, pretty much, you know, believe essentially what it is now is, and it doesn't mean that you can't criticize the Israeli government or the Israeli state or the action. It just means that you think that there should be this one place in the world, a tenth the size of the UK, where Jews have self-determination.
Is this following historic systematic oppression of the Jews from both biblical texts of Torah, or referring specifically following events in World War II, or the Holocaust, basically?
I mean, Zionism as a term was... Mm. Came about in the 1890s, I think, so way before the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
It was a political movement, but it was in response to anti-Semitism in Europe, including the pogroms in Russia, and the realization that Jews had no, after 2,000 years of being at various points kicked out, murdered, raped, and forced to convert, that we had no power because we had no safe space to exist. And that's and Zionism, of course, because Zion, Mount Zion, Jerusalem is, that's Zionism is now the word for the land of Israel or Jerusalem. So that's how it began. But of course, after the Holocaust, the case for it became much more urgent with, you know, at the time there were, I think 1939, there were 17 million Jews, and we're still not up to that many Jews, now it's only 15 million still. So we still haven't recovered our numbers. But the reason I ask, and it's the tricky one here, but although, to be honest, I've had conversations with many of my friends, so it's not something that negates friendship, but there was a few things that you said, Dane, that I just wanted to, I guess, sort of clarify So one thing you said was that there was a lot of anti-black sentiment, particularly amongst Zionists. I don't know if you remember saying that during the poll. What I would say is that, well, first of all, I would say that's just wrong. No offense.
I'd much rather know that's not the case.
Yeah, it's not the case. I mean, you know, because you talked about Mizrahi Jews, and Mizrahi Jews aren't actually Ethiopian Jews. Ethiopian Jews are called something different. They're called Beta Israel, which means House of Israel, which is a slightly different thing. But Mizrahi Jews are the Jewish people who lived in the Middle East, basically Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Yemen, and they existed in those other countries in the Middle East actually before Israel was destroyed by the Roman Empire and Jews sent off on the diaspora and stuff, because there was the destruction of the first temple. So there have been Jews in those countries, for thousands of years before Jesus' time. And those Jews now, mostly pretty much all live in the land of Israel. And those Jews are, I should say, brown, essentially. Mm. So, and they consists of about 60% of the Jewish Israeli population.
Right.
So the idea that they're racist against themselves, I don't think that's the case.
I mean, I should probably clarify that. I was probably referring to, I guess, what would be referred to as white passing Jews, or I guess Ashkenazi Jews.
Sure. I mean, I'm a white passing Jew, and I don't believe myself to be racist, not more than any other quite classy person.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But I just, this idea that Zionism is racist is a falsehood. Like you said, you know, there are Ethiopian Jews, Indian Jews, Chinese Jews, at the European Eurovision Song Contest, Israel was represented by an Ethiopian Jew who was brilliant, I thought, and very beautiful. And I'm not saying that there isn't racism within Israel, but
that just goes for every group of people in the world ever, isn't it? Really, that you'll always find some minority or percentage, right? In almost every group.
Well, there's a few, because like Dane, you mentioned this sterilization program, and that unfortunately was sort of retracted pretty much a couple of weeks after this one article came out, and then it was reprinted in The Guardian and The Independent. And the original source for it, it was actually misquoted, and there was like a big investigation in Israel. It was shown not to be the case. And so there's a part of one of the ways of delegitimizing Israel is to try to say that it's a racist endeavor. Mm. And I think that unfortunately, but saying things like the sterilization program and stuff, which have been, you know, and there are lots of articles out there showing how this is, it isn't the case. And in fact, there's a massive population explosion of Ethiopian Jews in Israel. I think that it ties into that narrative,
right,
which isn't... anyway, that's... Hey, so should we get the next question?
Because I guess I think why I would probably be more explicit in talking about the nuance of anti-blackness within Israel is because obviously there is, because as you said, you've correctly identified, there are obviously black Jews and you have the, and also, you know, a sect of Ethiopian Jews as well who have very close links to Jewish lineage.
And they're Jewish as far as
they're just Jewish. And so I think there's some of a narrative of affinity or commonality between the journey of the Jewish and African diaspora following chattel slavery and the Holocaust. So I guess there's more of a surprise when there's such a congruence in experiences between the Jewish population and the African diaspora. And I guess a large part of that preconception for me comes from the what tends to be the pro-Israel lobby that also seems to share several alt-right and very racist rhetoric, particularly from
in America.
United States.
We're talking about,
in America. Yes,
sure.
So I guess that's where that would stem from, and it's kind of like, I guess that's based on not having that clear of an idea of the ideological disposition where race relations is concerned of most Zionists, other than the ones that you hear in America who themselves aren't typically of the Jewish faith.
They're absolutely, but there's the Christian far right, and you know they're not people I'm not fans of them. But I think that there's also this sort of movement to try and understand Israel through the idea of American racism, and it's just not a similar situation over there. What racism there is. And if you think of it as different sects of Judaism, and if you think of how they are in a very small space and how they have integrated, comparing that to different sects of Christianity, where there's still strife and years of tension, but also outright war between different sects of Christianity in Northern Ireland and Scotland, or you have all what's going on in the Middle East between different sects of Islam. So that for me is much more of those comparisons are, for me, much more indicative of what's actually happening in Israel, but without the sectarian strife to that level. Yeah. Do you see what I mean? If you compare it like that, then you think, actually, these guys are getting on pretty good.
It might be an extreme comparison. I guess the juxtaposition for me comes from the fact that it's like there is more and more clear evidence that America's previous administration actively encouraged or ratified the actions of neo-Nazis within the state. So, which for me, I've long existed as, like, you know, the polar opposite enemy of the Jewish diaspora's, you know, pursuit of self-determination and, you know, religious and personal freedom. So that's why it's kind of like, of all the allies to pick, like, and obviously we all need allies as we do kind of, we are embroiled in this kind of war for human consciousness, but of all the allies to choose, is that the allies that the Zionist lobby would choose, the people that actually took in Nazi scientists as asylum seekers? And
yeah, I mean, America, I mean, that's like allying American Zionists with Nazi scientists. That's the Nazi scientists are part of the American state, you know, and I think Israel does, you know, we're now talking sort of global politics, which is fine, but the point is that Israel does receive financial support and from America, and because there is a proxy war between Iran and America, and this goes back, you know, this is not a new thing.
Not just Iran, since Israel, you know, since 1947, they've been in war with many of those countries, right?
Well, I mean, let's say 1948, Israel declared its statehood and was instantly invaded by every single surrounding country, trying to wipe 50 million Arabs, literally just went, right, we're going to try and wipe them out. And it didn't work. And there has been many wars since then. But, you know, there are things that are words that are used in what is the present Israeli-Palestinian situation, like apartheid, like genocide. And they are, again, they're words to try and make this about race and are not actually true to what is going on the ground. Like saying apartheid, when you can't call Israel an apartheid state, when you have now the Arab minority are going into power and are part of the government now and have kicked out Netanyahu.
So, well, that's why it's going to be an interesting time to be doing these couple of episodes of the podcast,
I think going back to the original question as well, Josh, because that's an important point, is that for me, the understanding of, and I guess the affinity I have with the Zionist ideology, to me makes perfect sense. I guess it would have been because the mainstream media narrative or the accompanying narrative has always almost been the pursuit of a land of safety and self-determination for the Jewish diaspora, but at the expense of Palestinians.
Well, yeah, that's a problem, of course, and that was a problem since, you know, and in 1947, when the partition plan was recommended, the idea was to split that land as fairly as possible, even though actually the land was originally including Jordan, which is a huge country.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to say the Palestinian governments have been offered peace many, many times, including at that time, to take that land and to have it at their own as a state. And of course, West Bank and Gaza were controlled by Egypt and Jordan for like 20 years. And they didn't at that point in any time there go, we are creating our own Palestinian state.
And the level of details that you're, you know, sharing with us, Josh, is one of the things that I think is so absent in so many conversations. And so we're kind of put in this position where, and I think it's interesting just to relate this back to Ash Saka, who we had on the show, who I think spoke really well. You might find differences of opinion, right, in what you say with her, but I think she spoke really well and she was very...
She is way smarter than me.
But she really spoke really well. But you know what? I bet you could find, the reason I was bringing that up is I bet you could find something that she's posted on social media would make you go, oh, I mean, now you're just posting something that makes a load of gaps in the actual conversation that makes it narrowed into something that is not as simple as you're portraying it.
She starts talking about, the reason the thing is like she tweet about ethno states and stuff. And it's like, it's like, again, ethno state seemingly, you know, to make it, it sounds like a sort of Nazi discourse, you know, whatever. Mm. But let's look at what the ethno states that existed there. Pakistan. is an ethno state.
Yeah.
Well, I could argue that anything's an ethno
state. Yeah. Anywhere's a majority. Iraq, Iran. Yeah. I mean, these are ethno states. What's wrong with this one little tiny?
I mean, the history of America is a fascinating story of a battle of an ethno state. You know,
it's not like Jews are on, you know, and are trying to take over the world and take over like has happened with Christianity, like that's happened with Islam, taking over swaths of this planet and trying to control people. Jews just want this tiny little part of land, which is where we're from, to live in peace.
But that's where, for me, it does get complicated because I am not a religious person. I may be a Cohen, but I'm not a religious person. And therefore, you do, you know, whether it be with you or anyone who has, you know, kind of firm beliefs that our world should be governed by some basis of organized religion, I kind of, that's a bit of a problem.
Well, I mean, it's, but like you say, you're not religious. You're Jew, you know, you are a Cohen.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
We have a Cohen name. So this is the way I think it's explained being Jewish is, you know, we are a people who adopted a religion.
Yeah.
Which is why you've got a religious Jews, David Baddiel, who I highly recommend his book, Jews Don't Count. Well, it doesn't talk about Israel, but it's fantastic. And so that is really a better, there are plenty of Jews who are not religious in any way. But this Israel is where we originated. Mm.
I mean, aside from the theological implications anyway, can it not be said for like the collective consciousness of the Jewish community that like after being able to be witness to years of, you know, whether it's religious persecution as well as just, you know, genocidal persecution, yeah. It's not to be said that like, you know, irrespective of your religious inclinations, it's like, I want somewhere where my family and my offspring and my successive generations can just be fucking safe. And in so many instances, we've almost been wiped out. So, I mean, that narrative, which I guess some people would extreme as a more of an extreme form of Zionist rhetoric, but to me, it's understandable. But then it's by that token of understanding, the extreme side of that sentiment, I should say, it's understanding that is where I'm like, does the pursuit of a Jewish state have to happen at the expense of Palestinians' lives or civilians?
That's a great question. And when you go to Israel, and it's a country, people seem to sort of, I don't know how they, when they say it, it's like with such disgust or something, when you see it it's mentioned on social media it's a country, and it's actually an incredibly pluralistic country with mm-hmm. gay pride and it's like an oasis in the Middle East of pluralism mm-hmm. where, you know, 75% of the population are Jewish and 20% are Arab, Muslims. And then you've got about 5% of Druze and Christians and different other things. By the way, all living with equal rights. That's mm-hmm. that's a massive point. So when people say the word apartheid, it's such a ridiculous thing where every citizen of Israel has exactly the same rights. And you have Arab, Israeli mm-hmm. high court judges, doctors, a huge percentage of the Israeli healthcare system are Israeli Arabs, and now you have them, the Israeli Arabs, in government. So when people say apartheid, I believe it's actually denigrating to true apartheid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the thing. Now you're right in that. Does Jewish but one thing before I move to the next point is I just want to say that when you go to Israel, the reality it's just like. You're in any other sort of country in on Saturday is the day off.
Yeah.
And the Jewish holidays are the national holidays.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Not like it's like some alien world or whatever. It just happens to be.
It's not like they hand you a yarmulke at the airport when you get off the plane, right?
No, exactly. I can walk down the street wearing a yarmulke and not be afraid. And I'm sorry to say, that is not necessarily true in the UK, and that's certainly not to the point of being a non-aware of what I'm wearing. I have to walk down the street and be aware, and that is a place. I go to Israel, and you can wear a yarmulke and you are not concerned that someone might just randomly come up and punch you in the face, as happened to a rabbi a couple of weeks ago in Chicago.
I mean, I'm sure it's happened in several occasions, and that's probably it's only an incident that we've actually heard of, because obviously I'm more than aware of anti-Semitic microaggressions myself from living in the UK.
But I didn't answer your question, sorry, and I'll do that, which is, you know, does that right to be able to do that top Trump the
or another way of phrasing it as well, Josh, is there a way then of being able to distill Zionist sentiment or Zionist ideology from the phenomenon of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, peace is the occupation. First of all, let me say there is no occupation in Gaza. So what happened there was Israel gave that to the Palestinians as their own state. There are no Jews in Israel. Mm-hmm. There are no Israelis. You know, they handed it over. They removed all of their settlers and left them a $23 billion industry that was immediately destroyed, that then the Gazans voted in Hamas, a genocidal terrorist organization who kill homosexuals and subjugate women, and then declared immediate war on Israel. And part of Hamas's charter is the utter destruction of Israel, and not just Jews.
It's worth saying one thing about the rise of Hamas, which is that I think, if I'm not mistaken, when they were getting voted in, they slightly softened that in the election campaign.
They slaughtered any rivals after that point. They won by not a huge majority, but slaughtered all of their rivals, and have not had an election since that point, more than a decade ago. So there is no occupation of Gaza. Israel controls its border against Gaza. The other side of the border is Egypt, but no one gives Egypt shit about what they let in or out or whatever. Why is Israel going to let just anything go into the country which can then be used to attack it? Of course, the loss of life is terrible, but that if Wales was bombing London with 4,500 rockets, there's going to be no retaliation at all. And Israel, the lengths that they are aware that the world's media is on their cases, and rightly so, probably the most viewed war. And yet the lengths that Israel goes, they don't want to kill any innocent people. They go to insane lengths. They call up a house near a place that's like sending out bombs. And by the way, Gaza deliberately sets up its missile sites in. They found one in a school and in the civilian areas, deliberately so civilians will die. But Israel calls people up. There's conversations online and says, by the way, we're going to bomb you in 10 minutes. You have 10 minutes to get out because we're going to bomb a house down the road and we want you to be safe. That doesn't happen in any other war.
Do you reckon it's an automated service? When I heard that story the other week, I was like, I wonder if that's an automated call. Or if someone actually has to pick up the phone and go, hi, is that, just wondering if you want to get out.
Stop spam calling me.
I've quite happily just give, my question is folding into this Josh's question, because I'm going to just give we're going to move on to Dane's question in a little while, but my kind of continuation of this subject is, something I didn't really get onto with Ash, and I listened back to our episode with Ash, and I did think we did as good as you could do for 15 minutes of of conversation about something. You know, there was some stuff that people could take away from it. But the bit that I am fascinated by is why is it this conflict that obsesses the world?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, better get 30, better get 20, 20, 20, better get 20, 20, better get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Why is it this conflict that obsesses the world? That is such an interesting subject to me. And
absolutely. I mean, it's insane. You look at what's happening in Syria. 500,000 people have been killed in the last 10 years. Have you got 100,000 people in central London coming through and saying, no, because it's Muslim on Muslim violence? More Palestinians have been killed in the Syria conflict. It's totally, but because it's Muslims involved, no one cares. You know, you look at the Uyghurs in China.
Just to make clear that what you were saying, when no one cares, the press don't,
but it's not just that. What I mean
I think you're right, Josh. I think I think, you know, the world has been inculcated with the normalization of sectarian violence amongst the Islamic world. So much so, like you said, you have a proxy war, which is probably happening on a arguably larger scale than the Israel-Palestine conflict, because, you know, you have Russia as a superpower involved in Syria, as well as the States, as well as China having some involvement as well. That's had knock-on effects in terms of the change in the administration and now the very oppressive regime that's in Libya. So, you know, like, no one's really brought up Syria over the course of over a year because of the pandemic.
And that's where you get into this thing, and I can only say this to listeners, you know, with some kind of soulful meaning in my heart, as no, like, I just think we just please spend some, if you really want to care about some of these subjects, spend the time reading up on it and really trying to understand it. Don't just be these people kind of like flaccidly passing a retweet judgment on something.
That's easier. And really, I guess when we discuss conflict at this scale, the overarching narrative is the fact that none of this is okay. Like, none of these things where we are either, you know, turning a blind eye to proxy wars to enjoy some level of comfort here in terms of the lack of, you know, I mean, we're experiencing probably unprecedented political instability for a couple generations here now, but in comparison to what we see in places like Syria, like, it's minuscule. But it's so much easier, you know, people enjoy those benefits and we still enjoy comparative privilege by living in this part of the world. And the proxy wars that our administrations finance and profit from, we don't see the direct effects of that. But it's only a matter of time now as we're seeing more and more people wash up on our shores and more people trying to escape these kind of conflicts. So I know it's easy to say to people, don't do this, but it's like, the truth is, if we really want to examine this, we have to go on a larger scale and examine the fact that our country profits considerably from the sale of weaponry and torture implements to continue these conflicts.
Yeah, so, and it's that kind of thinking of the I always bring up Inception, don't I, Dane? Where like, go to the next level with this. Like, what? Don't just look at this ground level. Like, there's so much more to all of these conversations we're having.
What Ash said, you know, like Ash said about, you know, stop. No, don't read a tweet, or it's got to be longer than 180 characters or whatever it is. Yeah. You've got to read actual books and be interested in these things. And I consider myself a member of the left and yet,
I almost laughed when you said that, just because the amount of people on the left who will get angry by things
of course they don't. They're like, "Oh, we don't want you. We don't want you,
this is the problem, is that it's, I guess, this very rigid crystallization of the sub genres within leftist ideology that has made most people that would sit somewhere in a moderate part of the left, I'd say like quasi-socialist, like at least someone that would grown up in the UK understanding the merits of having a universal healthcare system, has begun to drift across the centre and now is, well, I guess you could describe their position politically now as Middle Eastern, because they're just like right off centre. So,
but I feel like one thing that Josh, you know, we just said at the start of this thing, and then we'll move on to Dane's question, is just that I remember talking to a comedian many years ago, this is pre-Me Too, and she was trying to explain to me how mental she thought it was that anyone could consider themselves not a feminist, when the definition that she said to me of what feminism is for women to be.
You can't even say it, Howard.
You can't even bring yourself
It was going to be such a good point as well. What a shame.
It's a dirty word. Look at your
feminism.
It's clear to me that you consider feminism to be like the bitter bile in your throat house. You can't even bring yourself.
I was trying to be really helpful. Anyway, my point was going to be that she was saying it's the idea of women should be equal, which how could anyone disagree with that? And she kind of pointed that out. This is quite a number of years ago. I was like, well, of course, everyone's a feminist then, right? And I think in the sense of, you know, that when you think about Zionism, the word has become so...
dirty word.
Turned into something that isn't just saying the Jews should have a homeland. Like, take away
self-determination.
Because also the Netanyahu government, and I don't want to go down this road really, but like...
Well, he's gone.
He's gone as well, which is why it's so interesting you having these conversations, is that you can look back on that era and go, well, okay... not quite really working for everyone. but they made massive mistakes, clearly. But those mistakes aren't just the mistakes on the, you know, for him, the mistakes that the other side were making. The leaders of these organizations are not competent.
But you've got to think though, for a significant portion of Israelis, he did a job which he meant to, which for them, keeping him safe. Now, that's not to say I'm a fan of his. But,
no, I get it. No, it's like with COVID. It's like with COVID, and John Boris went up the fucking ratings because he stopped you getting COVID. But I mean, he wasn't that good at it.
And for Israelis, he's stopping them getting bombed in their buses and in their cafes. So you know, by building the fence. So and that doesn't make things right. But you've got to understand that's their mentality in a country that sees itself under siege, that has on its border people declared to kill them and sending missiles on that note,
I'm going to steer it to Dane on this very interesting episode of Question Everything, where Dane, you had a question that you mentioned to me earlier. You weren't sure if you were going to mention it, but I think you should, about the anti-Semitism.
It's my favorite subject.
Well, it's
my hobby.
I think it's a very good one, and I think it's the reason why I try to frame your question is that I think it is a subsection of the larger discussion about race relations. And I wanted to find out how the Jewish community, from your perspective, and it being one of your favorite subjects, what is the consensus amongst the Jewish community in terms of the race report with regards to anti-Semitism? Because, you know, our country's... current political administration proudly declared that we are a shining beacon in terms of race relations and recognition and tolerance of social groups throughout Western Europe and the world, and that there is no real issue of structural institutional racism in the UK. Now, I know that me and the brothers and sisters were not feeling that, but Jewish community.
I mean, first of all, I say that the Jewish community just did, because the Jewish community in the UK has Black Jewish members,
we had them on the podcast as well.
And one of them, I can't remember his name. Please don't call me a racist for not remembering his name. But
he's got five kids. It's not easy remembering.
I don't even know what kids.
I do not know the name of every Jew ever. But they just did the British Board of Deputies, Jewish deputies, just completed a similar. Sort of study or report into black racism in the Jewish UK Jewish community. So because there have been issues, I think, with black Jews turning up to synagogue and not feeling welcome is the gist of it. The main thing that was really identified from this was the security guards. Now, Jewish schools have security guards, synagogues, Jewish institutions, all Jewish institutions. Why do we have security guards? Because people like to murder us. Mm-hmm. And in France, you know, a few years ago, you just had a Jewish school by an Islamist came in and killed a couple of kids.
And Anders Breivik's attack in Norway was targeting Jewish students as well, in the largest mass shooting since World War II.
And there are constant attacks, and there was a shooting that was stopped because there were the guards and having a sort of iron door. Anyway, point is that this study, one of the things it found out, which is the security guards who were hired were basically racial profiling, I guess, is probably the questioning black or non-Ashkenazi Jews as to their, and that's not, there are Sephardi synagogues in the UK. Sephardi means like Spanish of origin, who different, very dark usually, and also Moroccan, and then there are Ashkenazi Jews who look like me, who tan well.
Beautiful Mediterranean and, tans.
Yes, exactly. So yes, questioning that. So there were, and not, and that's wrong. And that is now, steps have been taken to educate the security on the door, who sometimes are of different nationalities themselves. They aren't Jewish necessarily, but they're of different nationality, to educate them as to being more welcoming. Also a few things like, you know, and in our synagogue as well, we have a few black Jewish members, and this is something I hadn't really taken in, but when I see a Jewish black member, I'm so excited that my natural inclination is to go, what's up? How did this happen? Where are you from? Like, what? Give me the full loadout. Now, that's me seemingly coming from an excited place of like, this is my dream. You know, this is what I've always wanted to be. The best of both worlds. And so, sorry for the cultural appropriation. Realizing now from these points and from these conversations that I had, and our synagogue, finished actually about a month ago, but just had an anti-racism program. It was 7 weeks of sort of 2 hours. So it's 14 hours of talking about all this stuff, about why that might be inappropriate. And of course, one person thinking they're being friendly, if you have everybody in the shul, the synagogue, going up and saying what, you know, and like having to justify yourself, how that could be actually not welcoming at all and othering. So there are things like that is something that the Jewish community is very eager to deal with, and to better.
What do you think, Dane? Do you fancy giving it a whirl?
It just seems remiss that, you know, there isn't normal, regular, interactive discourse amongst the Black British and British Jewish population with so much commonality in their experiences.
Jews have always been overrepresented in the civil rights struggle, certainly in America,
definitely, absolutely,
in terms of all the, and the lawyers and starting civil rights movements. Yep. But maybe the difference is that, you know, there is somewhat of an homogenous body, a Jewish body to be able to talk to, the British Board of Jewish Deputy. Yeah. Being black is such a...
It's a much broader definition, yeah.
What are we talking about?
Exactly, and there's intersectionality because obviously you have black Jews and black British Jews as well. So it's not as... I guess it's an interesting point to bring up as well, because when did a conversation about self-determination between groups comes up, a lot of the time, and I think it's a very regressive and very subversive tactic, a lot of the time, the state of, black prosperity is juxtaposed with that of Jewish prosperity. And this question, a very flippant question, people, why can't people be more like Jews? And I feel like it's not something we can necessarily compare. But then at the same time, I think there is such a nuance to both our experiences and so much intersectionality between those two journeys that, you know, when instances like, if I make an erroneous comment about my understanding of Zionism happens on a podcast, Or we previously discussed like some of Wiley's comments towards the Jewish community as well.
That was a good
episode. There should be an understanding where it's not a upheld belief that there is a sentiment of endemic and anti-Semitism amongst the black community that I've ever been aware of. And, you know, I'm sure it's not, you know, given the level of overrepresentation of the Jewish community within progressive ideology as well as civil rights, it doesn't seem that it would make sense that there is a accepted normalization of anti-blackness amongst the Jewish community either. So, but obviously we don't know for sure unless we continue to talk, because as I said, there's just been so many opportunities for, you know, the meeting of those two cultures, both artistically as well as socio-politically, that it's just weird it doesn't happen on a regular basis.
I think we should get some kind of, maybe we could start it and on the...
I'm going to get all of what you just said and put it on a t-shirt, by the way.
Yeah, well, no, we should, because I'm having a conversation because Ashley Blake, who's the producer for Little Britain, invited me to JW7 to have a discussion.
Yeah, I saw the JW3.
Yeah, JW3, sorry.
We should open up a little kind of monthly event. It's a black Jewish event. Behind the stage, there's a big, big fucking mural of Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. And we can all just get, I think, how can you not get behind that?
Move forward from there.
And then you Photoshop like Lenny and Zoe Kravitz in there as well. And can't go wrong.
Sammy Davis Jr.?
Pretty much, I'd say
yeah,
so.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's a great night out. We have to come up with
Goldberg in name only. Also, Mel Brooks.
No, she's not. She converted.
So, Goldberg.
Drake.
Yeah, Drake as well. Yeah, I'm Drake in there as well. And I also recall, I remember Mel Brooks making a film, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, with Dave Chappelle. I think honourable mention for that alone. So,
yeah.
I mean, I definitely have that work in there.
I think it needs a real brand. I have to go and talk to my branding team that I've just made up. That really, you want to get that brand right, no? You want to make it really catchy. But we should definitely work on that. I'm quiet for anyway.
No, I'm definitely.
Well, we've taken huge steps. Yeah. Huge steps today. Moving forward.
Yeah. And it is an interesting thing to I always the phrase whataboutery is a very popular phrase at the moment. And it actually quite upsets me in regard to this bit of the conversation regarding sharing experiences between Black and Jewish communities. It's not, you know, like nobody wants to try and win that competition. Nobody's vast history.
It's not a competition. Yeah. That's the thing. I think it is like, you know, some people try and represent it as a competition, and it's not. They are different experiences of prejudice.
But that being said, I think that's the thing, is that when you are contextualizing all of this, all these phenomena within the framework of capitalism, people tend to interpret these atrocities as a zero-sum game, because they feel like, you know, if you are experiencing it, what follows is going to be some level of remuneration or compensation that's going to come after it. And so there's this almost like this clamoring to be like, well, we've got it harder, so we deserve this, and we've got it harder, so we deserve this. But they've got this, so why should we care that much? Or, you know, aside from all of that, in some instances, it's not always within the commercial interest for people to care. And so, you know, through news cycles and 24 news cycles and through, I'd say, that level of manipulation, then it's very easy to move people's gaze to certain atrocities, which are very similar in nature, like you said, with sectarian violence in Syria, to move their gaze away from that and not really focus on, you know, China's treatment of Uyghur Muslims as well. People are very, or even in Burma as well.
Amazing how that's, no one's talking about that.
In Burma as well, that's been going on with the Rohingya Muslims, right? That's been going on for...
It's crazy. How is no, you know, a million Uyghurs in China that is genocide. That is sterilization and camps and whatever. And
I still get wound up about Australia. I still look at Australia at times and just think, what?
Are you talking about the mass, after the mass shooting? But they had a mass shooting in Australia last year.
Well, no, I'm talking about the natives who we just...
Oh, yeah.
Just
oh, been, what happened? Oh, yeah. My dad is straight. My uncle married an Aborigine woman. So all my cousins are Aborigine. So every time I see them, I love being Aborigine. Aborigine. I'm nearly there.
I mean,
with
that being said, it is to say, you know, Tasmania was the place of genocide. And, you know, absolutely, it's something that we don't really talk about enough. And I mean, I guess for me, I think, with the advent of this pandemic, where I think a lot of us learned that there are a lot of tenets to capitalism that don't have much of a structural or real, you know, scientific or factual basis. That, simply put it, we don't necessarily see money every day to fucking live. And I think by that token, that's made us ask larger humanitarian questions about the commercial interests that kind of fuel a lot of the conflicts on this planet. And, you know, when you look at something like, you know, the genocide that took place in Tasmania, is why I guess these questions are becoming a lot more intense, because, you know, I think people's understanding of theology and spirituality is changing over time. Mm. And so the justification and the basis for some of these conflicts, I think, are coming into question again. But then that being said, I think overall there's a larger humanitarian question, and it's the preservation and the, you know, nurturing of human life should be, isn't that like the cornerstone of all Abrahamic religion? So I guess that's part of the larger conversation, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I got to say, Dane, it sounds like you have used the lockdown a lot better than I have.
Dane Baptiste will be in politics within the next decade. It's
I'd just barely be able to
get out of bed.
No, but you're doing
out of bed.
You're doing what you're supposed to do.
Chuck some mass questions at my kids and be like, leave me alone.
But this is it. I think
we haven't even talked about
you're educating your kids, you know, for the next generation. And
this is the thing. Badly, I'm educated. That's the problem.
Yeah, but how
much thicker than
how much can
were.
You fuck you up equations, argue, Josh? Come
argue,
on, mate.
You could argue, Josh, how relevant is a human being with mathematical knowledge in a world of artificial intelligence and binary code where these calculations can be done thousands of times faster by technology we've created? You know, so I would say
I think you're overestimating the intelligence of my children. The skill set they have is they're not quite there yet to binary programming.
Now it has been. I hope our listeners have enjoyed a slightly different episode with a real focus throughout the question. I really enjoyed today's episode, Dane.
No, absolutely, man. And I think this is the most important part of these discussions of ideology, is that you need these conversations to take place with people that are actively involved in these situations. Like, there would be no way we could have a conversation about, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict without speaking to somebody who is a Zionist and someone. And, you know, it goes to show you that, you know, the respect I have and kinship I have with Josh precedes, you know, your theological, ideological disposition. So we should be having these conversations all the time. Like, we may not agree, but we have a mutual respect. And so there's no reason why this conversation can't take place and find that mutuality.
I feel like we have found the mutuality. And to be honest, a lot of things you said, we totally do agree on. And it is amazing to have these conversations. And I just want to point out, I'm not some spokesman for Israel or something. I'm just a normal Jewish guy.
That's what it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be spokespeople and pedagogues and like, you know, and ideologues. It's supposed to be a regular Jewish guy and a regular Muslim woman. These are people that should be able to have discourse.
But you don't hear those voices whenever they get in people to talk about that or to talk about trans issues or talk about it. You know, they're not getting in people to actually who are living that to talk, you know, they're getting in other people in, which it's not like other people's opinions aren't valid and important and knowledge is and don't have knowledge about things, but it is nice to hear also the people who are directly involved.
Absolutely.
And the reason why I have to learn dates and things is only just to fight this sort of insane disinformation that's out there.
Absolutely.
That I've sort of seen over the and bleeds unfortunately into real world racism of
Absolutely.
You know, like I say, a rabbi being attacked in the street and convoys of cars driving through Jewish areas screaming to rape Jewish daughters and gangs of men walking around central London calling for Jewish blood. You know, what is going on?
And the thing is, it's one of these situations whereby, you know, as I'm sure ancestors and relatives will tell you, like, it doesn't start off with this immediate, like, voracious calling for Jewish blood. It's these incremental normalizations of hatred and flip and anti-Semitic comments. And, you know, from my perspective, as a black dude taking it day by day, a race report in this country where they're like, nah, there's no racism. You're like, hold on a minute. I mean, that in itself is pretty bold. And then it's how they do it as well. They're like, yeah, look, this Kemi says so. You can trust her. Like, never seen her in Antalya. Like, the former Minister for Racial Equality, Trevor Phillips, then joined UKIP. I mean, it's unprecedented times. But no, this conversation has been very useful. Yeah. I hope it's been useful for our listeners as well. And for the listeners, we are always more than happy to continue this conversation. We are not under any kind of a misguided belief that we can solve it
and
with
please don't tweet abuse at me. I really can't handle it. I get so much abuse from like Corbynites and death threats and emails through my website.
Send Josh nice messages, everyone, if you can.
Or if you don't want to hear it, guys, don't go to Josh's shows. But if you do want to hear good stuff and you are a lesbian who can control your affections towards Josh, that's a conversation for another time, but it makes sense when you see it. Then yeah, Josh, let our listeners know where they can hear more about your good works in terms of your combating against anti-Semitism and comedy as well.
Yeah, but please follow me on Twitter, Josh X Howie. If you'd like to listen, say, I'm very proud. I did a series on Radio 4 called Josh Howie's Losing It. Both series are on the Sounds app, and I'm very proud of it. And if you like, it's not particularly Jewish.
It's not really. See, the thing is, it's interesting that, you know, I mean, that for me is a very good indicator of someone who's aware of anti-Semitism, is that you have to preface stuff by saying it's not too Jewish and it's not, like, you know, it's
just a guy having a kid.
Yeah.
That's really what it's about. You know. Who happens to be Jewish. Yeah. That's it.
Which is fine anyway, Josh. So fuck you if you have a problem with it.
Nice one, Josh. I'm so glad we did this. It was
absolutely.
It was
always
great.
Good to hear from you.
It's nice to see you guys.
Yeah, you too.
Although Dane, I can't actually presently see.
But I feel like you can feel me though, Josh. You can feel the love.
I can feel the good vibes. Yeah, so
that's all that matters, man. Just vibes. But yeah, thanks again, Josh.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Josh Howie. You can follow Josh on Twitter at JoshXHowie. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQEPodcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.